1984. It is a dark and dismal time in the history of our race. An evil shadow has fallen across our once fair land. A certain vile, alien people have taken control of our country. When the day comes, we will not ask whether you swung to the right or whether you swung to the left. We will simply swing you by the neck. This is war.
The right-wing sect which declared war on the United States government in 1984 had many names. The Brüder Schweigen, German for Solid Brotherhood, the White American Bastion, and the Order. Former members revealed that a special order assassination squad plotted to kill the heads of three commercial television networks, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, and television producer Norman Lear, among others. The unquestioned leader of the order was Bob Matthews, a well-liked lumberjack from upstate Washington. After more than a year of tracking Matthews, FBI agents surrounded him in an island hideout near Seattle. During the shootout on December 6, 1984, the house caught fire. When it was over, Matthews was dead.
Yeah, the house magically caught fire. Ha ha! We know. We know how it caught fire. They set it afire. And there's been several others, white separatists, who have been burnt alive the same way. When they can't get you out, they burn you out. That's an old tactic. It really worked great for the feds at Waco. Oh, do you remember Waco when all those men, women, and children, a whole lot of children were burnt to death by elements of the United States military, the FBI, all of them? Do you remember that? You better not forget it. They will gladly do the same thing to you if you give them too much trouble and resistance. Well, it's July 5th, 2017, and this is Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. Most of these guys in the Order Brüder Schweigen never ask for sympathy, never ask for anything but to fight. And they went down fighting, and they are imprisoned, still fighting as much as they can. The Great White Battles were performed by guerrilla warfare, not ones where you're given an order to march straight ahead into the musket balls. No, guerrilla fighters. And that's what'll win the day in the future at some point. It never stops. Guerrilla warfare is the greatest. That's where the ISIS didn't do right. It chose the wrong way. If they stayed in smaller groups and guerrilla warfare and hit and run and like that, they'd be okay. But they decided to try to take on the opposition head on, and that's not possible. I guess the only ones that are holding out over there are the ones that came down from Europe and Asia. I guess the indigenous ISIS people are not very many of them around. But you got to give them credit. They're fighting to the death. I give credit to anybody that's willing to fight to the death. Boy, I tell you, it was like a war zone out here yesterday and last night. It was absolutely ridiculous. And these people really don't appreciate the revolution at all, or any of this stuff. They march down the street with all their flags unfurled. Yeah, they had a big parade out near me. I didn't even go watch it because I don't have any confidence or any faith in these people. They don't know why people died, and they don't know the reason or anything else. And I have no use for them. And I don't participate in their crummy little exposés of so-called patriotism. Patriotism to what? What are you patriotic to? Yeah, I'll tell you. They say love your country. Well, I don't think it's about loving your country. You might like your country or the land you live on, but I'm sure you don't like the whole country. I sure don't. I wouldn't want to live in most of the country. You love your family, you love your wife, you love your kids, you love your ancestors. That's where you put your love. But you always got to remember to retain hate. hate is a formidable weapon. The reason the system doesn't like it, it uses hate 24 hours a day. But they don't want you to use hate because they know it's effective. Hate your enemies and love your friends. The media is a riot. It's funny, but it's dangerous. One of the most dangerous systems in the country is the media. Only about 6 corporations control all the TV and radio news. So you wonder why you get it screwed to you. And they talk about Trump. It's great when he unloads on them. It's great. I've had enough experience with the media to last me 100 years. I know exactly how rotten, filthy they are. And when they talk about loving everybody or even loving the niggers, they don't love any of these people. They just want ratings and make lots of money. At least Fox is honest. They put half-naked girls up there on front, good-looking women. At least we get something out of this thing. And what do the progressives put up? Rachel Maddow. I'm pretty sure she's a homosexual. In fact, I know she is. That's what you're supposed to look up to, white men. I think I only remember one good-looking woman on the left. And that was years ago. I think it was Helen Gurley Brown. She was a women's rights advocate. And I'm pretty sure that was her name. And she was a foxy lady, but boy, Bella Abzug and all those people. Oh, Jesus. They have to work real hard to pick the ugly ones. Now, the book I'm going to read to you from today is Letters from the Front. I don't mean the Second World War or Vietnam or Korea. This was the First World War. And the first chapter is Life in the Trenches. You've probably heard about the Battle of Somme, where I believe 1 million men died in that one battle for the military-industrial complex of the day. Forward. If the British government has been criticized for one thing more than any other since the outbreak of the war, it has been the secrecy with which the officials of the War Office have cloaked the operations in the field. Well, they do that all the time. The censorship established at the beginning of the hostilities has been the target for severe and unremitting attack. From the platform and the press, the fact that the professional war correspondents, who started off so confidently to report the World War, have been obliged to knock their heels together, scores of miles from the firing line, has been the source of widespread neglect or regret. You know, there was another book, too, you might want to look up. Truth, the First Victim of War, something like that. The censorship established at the beginning of hostilities has been the target for severe and unremitting attack from platform and press, and the fact that the professional war correspondents, who started off so confidently to support the World War, have been obliged to knock their heels to. Well, I read that. As a matter of fact, however, the present convulsion in Europe, which has been called the War of No Correspondents, is in reality the War of 1 million correspondents. No war in history has been recorded with such a wealth of detail as will it be this, the greatest of all wars. The future historians will have a greater quantity of material to draw from than the historian of any previous war, and this for the reason that the men engaged in the present conflict find their chief source of amusement when off duty in writing of letters. This means that at least 6 out of every 10 men involved are war correspondents. Was ever a war so completely covered? Naturally, the public are not being informed of the progress of events with the same dispatch as which prevailed under the old system, which permitted the presence of trained correspondents at the front. Yeah, to give information to the lie papers. But it is doubtful if the old system of reporting a war would measure up to the requirements of the present conflict. Necessarily, the correspondent could only record the progress of the particular army to which he was accredited. And since there are a score of armies at present engaged in various parts of Europe, his view would be too circumscribed to be of very great value. Indeed, it will probably be years before the standard record of the war will be compiled, for the author will require a perspective which only time can give. However, if we are losing in dispatch, we are gaining in heart interest. The letters of the soldiers lack much of the grace of the reports of the correspondent, but on the other hand, they deal in the intimate manner with the things which the correspondents would be obliged to pass by, but the things at the same time which most interest the relatives and friends of those engaged in the struggle. The war correspondent confines himself for the most part to the movements of armies. The letter writer for the most part confines himself to life of the men. In present conflict, the press bureaus of various belligerent countries are furnishing the public with news properly seasoned of the progress of the campaign, while soldiers are supplying the details through the medium of letters. It follows, therefore, that a collection of these letters, written with no attempt to be at being impressive, but merely with the idea of setting forth the facts, can convey to the reader an understanding of the actual conditions obtaining at the front, which no series of communications, official or semi-official, can give. The letter included this volume have been sifted from thousands published since the outbreak of the war. With a few notable exceptions, they possess no claim to literary distinction, but they do visualize the glories and the horrors of the struggle, and all unconsciously pay eloquent tribute to the bravery and devotion of the average British soldier. This is, of course, written from a British point of view. And the date is December 1914. The following letter thoroughly characterizes of the pluck and cheerfulness of the young British officer has been received from a cavalry subaltern. Quote, "Your 2 hours of cigarettes were heaven. We've been in the trenches 2 days and nights, but no excitements except a good dose of shrapnel 3 times a day, which does no one harm and rather relieves the monotony. I've gotten my half troop, 12 men in this trench in a root field, with the rest of the squadron about 100 yards each side of us, and a farmhouse half knocked down by shells just behind. We get our rations sent up once a day in the dark, and 2 men creep out to cook the tea in the quiet intervals. Tea is the great mainstay of our service, just as it was on maneuvers. The men are splendid and happy as schoolboys, and we've got plenty of straw bed. We only had 1 pelting night, and we've had 3 or 4 fine days. We have not seen any German infantry from this trench, only 1 patrol and a sniper or 2. Their guns, too, are out of sight, but hardly a mile away. Quote, "Our first day's real close-up fighting was October 19th. We cavalry went on about a day and a half in front of the infantry. We got into a village, and our advanced patrols started fighting hard, with a certain amount of fire from everything in front of us. Our advanced patrols gained the first group of houses and we joined them. Fighting came from a farm in front of us, and then a man came out of it waving a white flag. I yelled, quote, 200, white flag, rapid fire, but wouldn't let us fire. Then the squadron advanced across the root fields towards the farm. dismounted in open order, and they opened a sharp fire on us from the farm. We took 3 prisoners in the roots and retired to the houses again. That was our first experience of the white flag. We lost 2 killed and 1 wounded. Quote, then I got leave to make a dash across the field for another farm where they were sniping at us. I could only get halfway. My sergeant was killed and my corporal was hit. We lay down. Luckily it was high roots and we were out of sight. But they had fairly got our range and the bullets kept knocking up the dirt into one's face and all around. We just lay doggo for a while and we crawled back to the trench. I was pleased with my troop under bad fire. They used the most awful language all the time, even after the men were knocked over within a yard of them. I longed to be able to say that I liked it. After all, one has heard about being under fire for the first time. But it is beastly. I pretend to myself for a bit that I liked it, but it was no good. But when one acknowledged that it was beastly, one became all right again and cool. After the firing had slacked, we advanced again a bit into the next group of houses, the edge of the village proper. I can't tell you how muddling it is. We did not know which was our front, and we did not know if our own troops had come around us on the flanks or whether they had stopped behind and were firing into us. And besides, a lot of German snipers were left in the houses we had come through, and every now and then bullets came singing into us like by from God knows where. 4 of us were talking in the road when about a dozen bullets came by with a whistle. We all dived for the nearest door and fell over each other, yelling and laughing. Said, I have a bullet through my best new Sandin Twilight breeches. We looked and he had. It had gone clean through. He didn't tell us until 2 days after that he had gone through him too. But there it was, like holes you make to blow an egg, only about 4 inches apart. We stopped about 2 hours, then the cavalry regiment on our left retired. Then we saw a lot of Germans among the fires they had lit. They set the houses on fire to mark their line of advance. They were running from house to house. We were told not to fire for fear of our own people on the other side. Then came a lot of them, shouting and singing and advancing down the street through the burning houses. One felt a particular hatred for them. We heard afterwards that there was a division of infantry. At first we thought there were only a few patrols. We retired about 2 miles and dismounted for action. Soon they began to come up from 3 sides and we retired again. They were pretty close, advancing higgledy-piggledy across the field firing. They shot abominably, nothing like the morning from the houses when they had all the ranges marked to the yard. We lost only about 20 horses. No men were killed. Hellfire Herbert got his horse shot out from under him when they were within about 200 yards. He was the next trooper in front of me. I suddenly got complete 4 hours when he saw me. I got him a spare horse, and he was still laughing and cursing them with a sort of triumph. We only trotted away. A man in my troop kept touching his cap to the German, saying, third-class shots, third-class shots. The next day we went forward to another place and introduced against a very big German force, but we only had to face their guns. Poor was killed. They pushed us pretty hard back to our infantry. We were supposed to have done well. Since then we have been doing infantry work in the trenches. We have been out of work in our trenches, only shrapnel and snipers. Someone described this war as moments of terror. It is sad that it is such a bad country for cavalry. Cavalry worked here against far superior forces of infantry like we had the other day. is not good enough. The Germans are dashed good at that house-to-house fighting business. It is horrible having to leave one's horses. It feels like leaving half oneself behind, and one feels the dual responsibility all the time. I hope that we can get them to run soon, then will come our chances. They have been having terrific fighting on the line on each side of us, and it has gone well. Quote, I adore war. It is like a big picnic without the objectiveness of a picnic. I've never been so well or so happy. Nobody grumbles at one being dirty. I've had my boots off once in the last 10 days and only washed twice. We are up and standing to our rifles at 5 a.m. when doing this infantry work and saddled up by 4:30 a.m. when with our horses, our poor horses, don't get their saddles off when we are in the trenches. The dogs and the cats left in the deserted villages are piteous, and the wretched inhabitants trekking away with great bundles of children in their hands. I can make out what has happened to the Battle of the Azan. It seems to have gotten tired and died. The following graphic description of life in the trenches has been forwarded to a London newspaper by the mother of the writer. It is from a British infantry officer and is dated October 31, 1914. Thank you very much for all the parcels. Yesterday they arrived, cigarettes, a pillow, soap, and so forth. The soap amused me. The only water I have seen in the last 4 weeks is the precious water we get for drinking. I have not washed even my face and hands in 3.5 weeks. Nevertheless, I have been completely soaked through several times, and no doubt that washes you a bit. I have a huge beard, ginger-colored, and look exactly like Consul. After a fortnight's scrapping, we have been dug in here for a week. The night before last was the coldest I have ever known. It rained hard for 2 hours, and the trench then became a foot or so deep in mud. I got 3 hours sleep just before dawn. There were 2 nights attacks that night, and during that time the sky cleared and it froze. When I got up, I was covered with ice and frost. We can seldom get much rest even at night, as there are continual alarms, and in the day the shells completely prevent one sleeping. The moral effect is very great. A huge shell burst near one of my officers, and it so affected him that although not wounded, he had to go to the base. Yet he was a big, strong fellow who had served 15 years in the Natal police. That's in South Africa. In 1 hour, he was up in France fighting that stupid war in France, and he was from South Africa. In 1 hour, the flames and concussions of certain shells which came from the spot in the sixes and eights 6 times hurled me against the wall of my dugout without hurting me, but it does shake one up terribly. I stumbled and the point of my sword went clean through my foot, luckily at the outer edge only. It is all right now, and I did not have to go to sick bay. It was lucky I did stumble, though, as otherwise a bullet would have touched my hat. That touched my hat would certainly have gone through my brain. During that attack, I had a man on either side of me shot dead more than once. These German bullets, when they hit a bone, turn over and make the most awful hole like a dum-dum. We shot 4 captured Germans found with dum-dum ammunition. All night, the cries of the wounded and the dying are very distressing to hear. Of course, the man who groans most is the man who is unconscious and has hallucinations or something. Something of the sort. We have hardly an officer left, but luckily only about 6 have been killed. The day after our attack, the Germans attacked us, and we had to withdraw 3 miles at dusk. They lost 7,000 killed and wounded in front of our division. 7,000 white men. An officer in the 1st Cheshire Regiment writes, quote, "When one reads the papers in England about the cheerfulness of the troops, the good food they get, and the way they get daily papers in the trenches, one doesn't realize what it really is. If there is such a thing as hell on earth, this must surely be it. I have been in the firing line for 4 days, in the trenches for 3 days, and just behind in support today, which isn't much better. But after all, I've been lucky so far, though I feel absolutely exhausted. The day before yesterday, I had to go through open fire 4 times, advancing and giving messages. And but for bad shooting, I would not have been here now. They shell us nearly all day. They have to creep into the farthest corner of the trenches, expecting the infernal things to burst on you. Luckily, the Germans don't seem very fond of doing much at night. But then we are busy digging new trenches and doing all sorts of things. When I arrived there, were only 5 officers in my company, none higher than a 2nd lieutenant, and now I am one of the 2 left. Still, we are all certain of winning in the end, which is a great thing." They don't get it. They just don't get it. "At present, we are holding back thousands compared to our hundreds. They attacked yesterday and today en masse, but were driven back. I haven't washed or had my boots off since I got here, and I am mud almost head to foot, including my hair. The spirit of the men is wonderful. They make some very odd remarks, which is rather a change. It seems odd sitting here writing with shells flying about. Fortunately, I and my section are behind a haystack this afternoon for a change. The beastly Maxim machine guns and rifles are just starting again. May have to go any minute. A small dog has just stepped on the letter. But I am not going to make any excuses for dirty paper or writing. A Jack Johnson, as Tommy's called them, has just burst about 50 yards away and no damage this time. There's another and another and again and so on. Whenever I hear one shrieking in my direction, I offer up a fervent prayer. Another waste of time. This letter is getting very much disturbed at the present. A small piece of shrapnel, only a yard or two away, and they have been nearer than that. My word, here's a near one. Crash, bang. Would I could get the Kaiser here." An officer who is second in command of a British infantry regiment now in Belgium has written a letter in which he gives a very realistic description of fighting under modern conditions of warfare. He says, "I did not think I should ever live to write to you again. There is a most frightening battle raging. Our men are in the trenches, shelling and sniping it all day and attacking by night. No rest and little food. I'm using a cellar for my office work, as the house I was in was knocked to pieces. They make craters 16 feet by 8 inches in the ground and carry whole houses away with one shot. The suspense as you hear them singing towards you and don't know whether they will land near you is very trying. You imagine what that does to a body if it tears a house totally complete to pieces. The shrapnel prance merrily down the street. Inferno is loose. If you poke your nose out of a trench, a bullet whips past your ear. I'm very glad to be in my cellar." "I can't do any more in the trenches here at last, at least. I can arrange for fresh supplies of ammunition, water, and food and tea for the men in the advanced trenches. We have fought now for 7 days and nights on end, and there seems to be no finality about it. Since I arrived, we have only had 3 days not under fire, and then we were marching all the time with practically no sleep. We have just been attached to another brigade, and my hope now is for more of the men, as many and soon as possible. If people at home would only realize that the more men we have out here, the less loss we shall sustain, and the sooner the war will be brought to a successful close. How the French troops suffered, the poor souls, crossing the open. All dead lie there still. No one can get to them, as the snipers shoot at anyone who approaches. There may be wounded among them, but they must be dead by now, as after a pelting day a bitter wind is blowing. Again, I am in a house, but all glass and half the roof have been gone, and the field outside is covered with French and English dead. Private W. Weir of the Green Howards, who lies wounded in Leeds, writes to a friend at York that on the road to Ypres, the British found carcasses of horses which German troops had killed for food, describing a retirement before superior numbers. Private Weir goes on, quote, Sunday, the 25th, was the day of all days. They started shelling us as soon as 8 o'clock in the morning, and at dusk we had lost 37 out of 50 in my trench. It was like a slaughterhouse. It was full of blood. One of their aeroplanes came over us and dropped smoke lights, and shells started again. They blew part of our trench in, burying 6 of our fellows. When they were got out, 2 were dead, and 2 deaf and dumb. I was spotting some Germans digging a Maxim trench when a shell burst in my face. I can't explain what it was like. I fell down like a ninepin. My chums bandaged me up, and I lay in the trench till night, because our ambulance men dare not come for us till then, as the Germans fired at them. They have shelled every hospital we have had, and plenty of the RAMC have been killed. We had to walk to Ypres to a convent where our wounds were dressed. I had a shrapnel wound in the chest and 2 in the right arm. These are boys of 15 and so on with the enemy. We can't hurt them because they are forced to do it. Poor boys. One boy we took prisoner was learning English. He said he did not want to fight, and that was his first day. He had been wounded in the chest and the leg and had lost one finger. Hand-to-hand slaughter. Sergeant McNulty, 2nd Loyal North Lancashire Regiment, writes, quote, on the Aisne, our trenches were just 300 yards from the German trenches. They called that space no man's land, and in the short distance were hundreds of dead men. We were never able to collect them or remove them from the battlefield. When we left the Aisne, we went right across France to the coast, and fighting there was fiercer than ever it had been before. It is practically hand to hand. Our orders were to drive the Germans from their trenches so as to fill up the gap between the Cameroons and the Queens. We lost heavily before we got near the Germans, and instead of being a mile away, they were 400 yards away. I had about 30 men under me when I started off. Before we got across a turnip field, more than half had been knocked over. We did not see a German then, but on looking over the crest, we saw their trenches were only about 100 yards in front. We wormed ourselves up under cover, made a dive, and we properly frightened them. Not a man of ours fell. We did not leave a man alive in the first row of trenches, and the second row no sooner saw this than they commenced hoisting white flags and waving butts of their rifles. They weren't excited about being in this bloodthirsty war, either side. Maybe the English were a little more bloodthirsty than the Germans. I don't know for sure. Evidently, Germans were running out of men and were employing young guys 15 years old. William Payne of New York, whose chateau Alphandes Forets at Rosy and Maltoux, Ossise, 38 miles from Paris, was wrecked by the Germans early in September, has written the following account of the affair and the condition in which he found his property. The English arrived in the chateau on Wednesday, September 2nd, and out of respect for the three American flags conspicuously displayed, the officers did not enter the chateau, but slept in the three chauffeurs' bedrooms in the outbuildings, in the park and elsewhere. The English officers, being greatly fatigued, asked our head gardener if it was possible to have a bottle of good wine. The gardener answered that the American proprietor had the key to the wine cellar, but that he himself had some excellent wine which he offered. It was accepted, and the officers were quite satisfied. The next day, September 3rd, as the Germans were approaching in great numbers, the English left without causing any damage whatsoever to our property. The mayor of Rosseuil, the town policeman, and many others who remained informed me on their return to Rosseuil that the Germans arrived the 3rd in great numbers and occupied our chateau as well as those of the mayor and others from that date until the 9th, when they pushed back towards Saison and Reims by the Allies. They also testified that three American flags were torn down by the Germans on arriving, one large one from the front of the chateau and two smaller ones from the two entrances. No words can describe the condition inside the chateau of the lawns and the alleys and the wooded park after the Germans had left. In fact, in many thousands of dollars worth of personal property, there was not enough left of value to pay transport to Paris and a commission on sale. All armoires, sideboards, vitrines, writing desks, closets in the 19 bedrooms, and elsewhere were opened by bayonets or heavy tools and all broken in many pieces or ruined. All articles taken from them were either broken, torn up, destroyed, or taken away. All objects d'art of value were taken away. All genuine silver, such as tea and coffee services, dining room service, gold and silver dressing toilets, silver mirrors and candlesticks were taken away. All that remained was a gold glove stretcher, a silver nail brush cover, flattened out and destroyed, and a candlestick broken in three pieces and some plated silver. All tables and other glassware and most of a porcelain table service, all of a large pharmacy stock for perfumeries, were taken or smashed into small bits. All ancient lace bedspreads, lace curtains, lace pillowcases, and various pieces of ancient lace, as well as the household linen or several of every sort, were used for the wounded to wrap around the dead before burying them, torn up and taken away. 19 bedrooms in the chateau and outbuildings were furnished complete. Not one blanket, sheet, pillowcase, or elderdown coverings, American or foreign, remain. All curtains were pulled down, soaked with blood and filth, linings torn out, destroyed or used for the covering the wounded. All bed and lounge mattresses, pillows, springs, and furniture were soaked with blood, medicine, or filth, and so on. No clothing, shoes, or hats were left of over $2 value, belonging to my wife, several, or my 8 servants. Some dresses of my wife's were slashed with knives and left hanging in her wardrobes. Shoes were taken, or what were left the pieces cut out, or the XXX cut in them across the toe cap, of over 1,000 bottles of wine, including 1880, 1884, 1889, 1892, and 1893 champagnes, some in magnums and gin bombs containing 4 quarts, 1860, 1870 port, were old red, white, and Rhine wines, besides old cognac liquors, whiskey, Benedictine, and so on. Not one bottle remains. Only broken and empty bottles were found strewn all over the chateau and the park. The chateau and the grounds were strewn with indescribable filth. Pieces of rare ancient Italian and Spanish lace were torn up and used for indescribable purposes, or taken away. All household articles were broken, scattered around, or carried away. This is what happens in war. Complete breakdown and barbarism, no matter which side you're on. Straw and hay were used for the many hundred soldiers sleeping on the lawns, besides for the wounded in the house. The stone walls are torn down or destroyed all around the chateau and the park. In about 20 places, walls were pulled down to the ground for the soldiers to pass through. The high walls, about 6 or 8 feet, were cut down so the soldiers could shoot over them. The 3 kitchen gardens of over 3 acres were partially destroyed and part of the high wall torn down. All vegetables, American and foreign, from 3 cultivated garden acres were taken or destroyed. Of the thousands of rare fruits, not one remains. Every garden tool of over 100 garden tools of American and foreign manufacture, all were taken away, with the exception of 2 spades used for burying dead Germans. Many dead Germans were buried on the lawn near the billiard room, and the German officer was buried a few yards apart with a cross placed above his grave. Other Germans were buried in the chicken run of all our prized hens and cocks, numbering about 150. Not one was left. All were either eaten or taken away. We were at one time sidetracked while a trainload of French wounded came and stopped opposite, so near that we could speak from our windows. The poor, pale men sat on long benches across the freight cars. 3 German soldiers stood in each doorway. As soon as the train stopped, Red Cross men quickly came with hot bouillon and sausages for the fat, well-looking sentinels. Nothing was given to the prisoners. I said to one of the Germans, "I suppose that you all speak some French." And he replied, "No, not yet." I asked if I might talk with the prisoners and give them some food. He said he might talk, but give them nothing save cigarettes. So P gave them all he had. The Frenchmen offered money and were deeply grateful. We told them of our sympathy. I asked them, the guards, how they could stand eating and drinking before these faint and suffering prisoners. They merely grinned and shrugged their shoulders. I was very angry, and our conductor came to me and said, "Madam, we are not cruel. We would feed them if we could." In a German prison, 2nd Lieutenant J.P. Pierce, 18, of Essex Regiment, who had been reported missing, writes from Krefeld, Germany, to a friend in Woodford Green. "I got cut off in the early morning and with only 8 men left alive and was surrounded by 200 Germans. We fired a few rounds more, but my revolver was empty, and we had to give in the end. We are treated very well indeed here. We have good beds and fires in the rooms, 3 good meals a day, and a French soldier for a servant, and a splendid hot bath. We have a large courtyard to walk about in, and a canteen where we can buy clothes and anything we want. Prison fare is very good, new rolls and coffee and fresh butter. I had a very decent guard coming up in the train. He got me food. When the man tried to get in to attack me, he threw him off the train." I am in no danger of being shot unless I try to escape. I shot the man who was carrying their colors, and he wanted to have me shot. But luckily, no one seemed to agree with him. The next time I saw him, he was bandaged up. He was shot through the shoulder. He dashed up and shook my hand and shouted, "Mein Freund!" I expect he was glad to be sent back to Germany. W beat him of the St. George Road, Southwark. Has received the following from a friend who signs himself Just Bill. "We're being treated thumbs up here, a little village the Germans held only last night, and the people are simply mad over us. The old people on this farm have given us everything we want for ourselves and our horses, even hot water for a dig out, and bags of straw for a kip. When the Germans are canned and full of Dutch courage, they fight like demons if they get the first shot home, which is very seldom. 3 nights ago, my party of 4 came across 18 of them. They saw us and opened fire at 100 yards. All the lot missed. We replied and got 2. When the others saw this, down went their lances and up went their hands. Result, we were pestered with 10 cowardly prisoners. The night before we reached this farm, the Germans pinched the poor old folks, only bed put it around the fire in the kitchen for themselves, and the farmer and his wife had to sleep on chairs in a cold room. It's only our officers who prevent us from going all the way with the brutes. Sometime we collar them by ourselves and then own back. Got me?" I guess that meant get even. From Private J. Kerrigan of the West Yorkshire Regiment to friends in Halifax. "The firing lines in the Assaine would be little more than 500 yards apart. We were subjected to severe fire from machine guns and shrapnel, and our men were falling like sheep. By the time the supports reached us, there were very few of the original line left. By keeping up a well-directed fire, we were able to hold on until about 3 o'clock, when the Germans made up their minds to come for us. About this time, we ran short of ammunition carriers, as our enemies shot them down every time they attempted to move. They captured about 60 of the battalion, took their rations from them, and after disarming them, made them march to the trenches. As soon as our chaps turned to obey the order, the murderous fire was opened on them. Nearly all of them were killed. At the roll call, all of a battalion of 1,100, there were about 200 of us to answer. The remaining had been killed, wounded, and taken prisoner. Lance Corporal D. Peach of the 4th Dragoon Guards writes to his sister and brother in East Kirby, "It was hell in the trenches last night. We have been on biscuits for 2 days, but got some bread this morning. My chum's bacon and my own I cooked on the smoldering ruins of a house which the Germans had set on fire. How those poor people cried when they came back to find their homes and belongings all gone." The following letter from a British officer at the front shows that not all German troops are wanting in chivalry instincts, and shows also how injurious the misdeeds of such affect others who are guiltless. "Opposite the trenches of 2 of our infantry battalions, they found 1,000 dead and wounded Germans, and there are still many poor devils of Saxons laying between them and the trenches, and no one able to get at them. Our men got in 30 of them the other night, and every time they went out, the Germans opened heavy fire on them at 500 yards. And we would probably have to do the same, as we cannot trust them not to attack on the pretext of collecting the wounded. They have done this repeatedly. Only once did the Saxons, who are opposite to us and good fellows, quite different from the Prussians, get into one of our trenches. They took a good many prisoners, but an hour after another battalion counterattack killed and wounded or captured all the Germans and released our fellows. some of these poor devils lay outside our trenches calling, "Comrades, comrades, English, come help us," all one night. Our fellows did their best to get them in, but the Germans poured volleys in every time. It was heartbreaking, and one would have given anything to succor these brave wounded Saxons who had behaved to our prisoners like true gentlemen. Treatment of prisoners. The following description of the treatment of English officers, prisoners of war in Germany, is taken from a letter written by an English wife of a German noble who paid a visit to one of these camps. The following description of the treatment of English officers, prisoners of war in Germany, is taken from a letter written. I said that they are all well and taken care of for, but owing to the hatred of and bitter feeling, they must be confined to a certain space for the sake of their own safety. They have two very enormous yards, which they play games and have international football matches with the French prisoners. Two new big wooden sheds are being built for them. They are nearly ready, in one of which the English have their Sunday church. And concerts. They have a piano, a harmonium, and a bandmaster, as many musicians are among them and the French. They have managed to make up a whole band, and instruments have been supplied to them. The second tenor of the Paris Opera is also there. They train every day twice for an hour. A famous rugby player is in a kilt leading them. They run races and have all sorts of drill in which all the elderly colonels join in and take orders from the youngster and standing at attention like recruits. These were English war prisoners in Germany. Well, let's see. I think that's about where I'll end it on the third chapter. We'll get back to it later. I do recommend you watch the film All Quiet on the Western Front. That's one of the best as far as showing visually on film how terrible the First World War was. And that's it for today, Wednesday. I'll be back tomorrow on Thursday, and we'll maybe read some more of this or get into something else. If you like it, I'll keep reading it. If you say nothing, I don't know what I'll do.
Millions of men have always died. Your leaders are bigots. The Pope lord on the Catholic Emperor. Your generals are bandits. Lord on the Catholic King of France. You employ any mercy you can get. Lord on the Catholic King of Spain. And the Pope plays politics. And by a hundred other princes, kings, bishops.
All for their own rotten purposes.
All sides are rotten, except for people like you. Religious fanatics who incite murder for the sake of a god they have never known. Don't you understand? There is no god!
Millions are dead and more will die.
Your leaders are bigots.
The Pope wars on the Catholic Emperor.
Your generals are bandits.
Wars on the Catholic King of France.
You employ any mercenary you can get.
Wars on the Catholic King of Spain.
And the Pope plays politics, helped by a hundred other princes, kings, bishops.
All for their own rotten purposes.
All sides are rotten, except for people like you. Religious fanatics who incite murder for the sake of a god they have never known. Don't you understand? There is no God! Michael.